So we meet Moses, this character who begins his life in a basket, sleeping peacefully as he's floating down the Nile. But he ends his life as a military commander. And that illustrates the fact that war is a significant part of the story in the Old Testament. Now, it may be that some of you here have actually come close to dismissing the Old Testament completely because of its attitude to war. How can the warlike God of the Old Testament be the same divinity as that is revealed in the New Testament, the God of love incarnate in Jesus? Sadly, war has always been a feature of the history of mankind. Someone has once said that peace is simply the interval between wars. And we all know that war causes untold suffering. Now, to try to apply a Christian voice to this isn't easy, and the church's voice has often been absent or actually ambiguous. And that's not surprising, because almost every war is the result of a really complex cocktail of causes. And there's often, normally, there is moral ambiguity in war. Nobody is ever really able to claim the moral high ground. But the difficulty we have as Christian people when we think about the Old and the New Testament is perhaps one difficulty, is that the New Testament itself has very little to say about war, whereas the Old Testament has a lot to say about it, a great deal to say about it, and much of what it seems to say is a bit offensive to the modern reader. And it may be a stumbling block to you. It may be literally causing you a question as to whether God of the Old and the New Testament is the same. And sadly, some texts in the Old Testament have actually been pretty dubiously used to justify war. In some ways used to justify the Crusades, or more recently wars against Native Indians in America. But then we have this problem, because Jesus and his followers down the ages have as a central belief that God is unchanging. So we could read both Testaments selectively. We could say that we don't like the Old Testament and ignore it. But actually, if we did that, we would ignore and miss out on some foundational truths about God, about his love and his faithfulness, if we didn't read the Old Testament. Equally, if you look at the New Testament, there are some very challenging words from Jesus about judgment and about hell. So we could be very subjective and selective about our reading, or we could try to engage with the whole thing. But the first thing to say really is that the Old Testament approach to war is complex, and in some ways it's contradictory. So what I want you to do with me is to sort of climb aboard, metaphorically, a helicopter, and we're going to take off and land at a few points through the Old Testament and see what they have to teach us about war. So our first stop-off point is Exodus chapter 15. Has everybody found that on page 72? Lisa, would you be okay to read that for us? Could you read verses 1 to 12, please?
The song of Moses and Miriam. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider, he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep waters have covered them. They sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger, consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood firm like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy boasted, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils, I will gorge myself on them. I will draw my sword and my hand will destroy them. But you blew with your breath, and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who among the gods is like you? Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them.
Thanks very much. So here we have what's called the Song of the Sea. It's a celebration of military victory over Pharaoh, whose army is washed away. And in verse 3, the Lord is described as a warrior. The Lord is his name. And roughly 2 million people are rescued in this event from slavery and oppression. So that God is a warrior expresses a fundamental truth about him. He is a commander under whom Israel can attack and defeat the enemy. And in this poem, we have some key words that describe him in terms of glory, strength, salvation. But all these words about God are given a military grounding. And yet, the way that the Lord wins this victory is most unusual. There is no actual fighting by the Israelites at all. They're in a desperate position of weakness, and God demonstrates his saving of them by a supernatural act of power, by floods and the angel of death. And the story demonstrates ultimately the justice of God, because God hears the cry of an oppressed nation and acts. But this cannot be by any human legal means that were open at the time, because no human court of law could bring Pharaoh to book, because Pharaoh was the law. But Pharaoh is not God, and he is still subject to a fundamental principle that is at the heart of the world order, if you believe in God. The law of equivalent retribution, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, in this account, water plays a key part. Pharaoh had decreed, way back earlier in the story, that all the Hebrew boy babies would be drowned in water. Moses is saved from the water in a basket. And you'll remember that the first plague that God visited upon the Egyptians was that the river Nile would be turned from water into blood. And eventually here, water is used as an instrument of judgment on Pharaoh's army as it is washed away at the Red Sea. So the defeat is not only demonstrating the justice of God as he saves an oppressed nation of 2 million people, but it's also symbolic. All that Pharaoh touches leads to death and destruction. So this is a triumph not so much over a nation, but a nation that was gripped by evil and megalomania. A rule of forces of chaos that are anti-life. But you say to me, it's rather unpleasant and awkward reading. Yes, it is. But the sobering thought is that if you fast forward to today, how many people are in slavery today? Well, a conservative estimate puts at least 25 million people across the world. To abusive landlords, to businessmen, to people in our country. What sort of actions might be required to free 25 million people? Asking people nicely? Knocking on the door and trying to persuade some of these people whose lives and businesses and livelihoods? No. Perhaps something bigger needed to happen then. Of course it did. And needs to happen today, maybe. Now, that leaves you with a question, of course, but I'm just trying to put it in the context of the enormity of the injustice. So let's get back into our helicopter, and we're going to take a short ride another 300 years forwards, fast forward 300 years, and we're going to go to 1 Samuel chapter 17, and that's on page 288. This is a familiar story about David and Goliath. I haven't got time, but you might want to read it back to yourself later. But I want to draw your attention to an important thing. In verse 1, it says that war was inevitable. The Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Sukkoth in Judah. So war was on the cards. But war does not start until verse 48, right at the bottom of the other page. As the Philistine, Goliath, moves closer to attack him, David runs quickly towards the battle line to meet him. So we've got a whole 48 verses of preparation for war. It's a common thing in the Bible that the lead up to the battle is seemingly endless, and the battle is described with breathtaking brevity. Well, you wouldn't do that if you were a filmmaker today, would you? Except if you were trying to save money on all the special effects and the fight scenes. So what is important in the Bible about war? Well, what seems to be matter above all are the motivations of those people taking part and their relationship to God. So we have this contrast between David, who is this young lad, slightly perhaps cocky and arrogant, because he just goes up to a king and tells him what's what. But he's full of faith and zeal, while Saul, the king, is full of fear and lack of trust. So this battle that's going on in the first 48 verses, or the preparation, is more of a theological thing than a military thing. The key thing is that Goliath has mocked the living God. He's mocked the God of the Jews. He's cursed David by his gods. If you look at verse 43, the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And David appeals to his God. And that would, of course, be very little use given the situation, unless David absolutely believed that his God was powerful. The Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, he appeals to in verse 45. So David's primary motivation is one that goes right back to the Exodus. The Exodus was about Israel witnessing to the cosmic supremacy of God, so that all the earth may know. And David wants to do that as well, and remind the Philistines, Goliath, who ultimately is in charge. And in the context of the ancient world, which was brutal, life was short, and the characteristic of the superpowers surrounding this small nation of Israel was incredible. They were described as a leopard with metal teeth by Daniel. They were brutal, megalomaniac leaders of the sort that we have seen in the last century being repeated across the world. It's difficult then to believe how a pacifist God could have made any sort of impression on those kind of people. But we want to note a few other characteristics about this particular example. The battle takes place on a very small scale. It is a battle of chosen representatives, and it's a very close battle, close enough for David to kill Goliath with a stone from a sling thrown over just a few meters. Now, of the day, even when armies were involved, a typical fight in these times would have been between hundreds, possibly thousands, but rarely thousands of men. And so the large numbers in the Old Testament are not really supposed to be taken as real numbers. They are more a picture. So an impressive victory by Jonathan, Saul's son, is described as killing 20 men. Well, compare that with the millions who were in uniform in World War I and II. There would have been a very, very needed to be a very strong motivation for a fight that would involve a fatal confrontation, because there were no doctors or nurses around to patch people up. So hand-to-hand contact of the type that's described here is obviously just about disappeared, really. We don't choose champions anymore to fight for us. And over time, horses and chariots began to become the strategic weapons of the day. But today we have a much larger and widely spread war. If you think about recent wars that have gone on in Iraq, for example, spread over a whole country. And many of the controlling points for those wars are distanced a long way away. So you have drone attacks from places, even different countries. And that means that the ethics of war is far more ambiguous and difficult. But we're back to the example that we've got here. So we've seen a couple of examples where there is war in the Old Testament. Now let's go to a place where we find some principles or some rules. So we're going to go back in our helicopter, and this time we're going to go to Deuteronomy chapter 20. So you need to come back. And it's on page 198. And I think we will read this together because it's actually quite helpful. Christy, would you read it for us? Verses 1 to 20 of Deuteronomy chapter 20. In other words, the whole chapter.
When you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them, because the Lord your God, who brought you up out of Egypt, will be with you. When you are about to go into battle, the priest shall come forward and address the army. He shall say, "Hear, O Israel, today you are going into battle against your enemies. Do not be faint-hearted or afraid. Do not be terrified or give way to panic before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you victory." The officers shall say to the army, "Has anyone built a new house and not dedicated it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else may dedicate it. Has anyone planted a vineyard and not begun to enjoy it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else enjoy it. Has anyone become pledged to a woman and not married her? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else marry her." Then the officers shall add, "Is any man afraid or faint-hearted? Let him go home, so that his brothers will not become disheartened too." When the officers have finished speaking to the army, they shall appoint commanders over it. When you march up to attack a city, make its people an offering of peace. If they accept and open their gates, all the people in it shall be subject to forced labour and shall work for you. If they refuse to make peace and they engage you in battle, lay siege to that city. When the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, put to the sword all the men in it. As for the women, the children, the livestock, and everything else in the city, you may take these as plunder for yourselves. And you may use the plunder the Lord your God gives you from your enemies. This is how you are to treat all the cities that are a distance from you and do not belong to the nations nearby. However, in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they would teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshipping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. When you lay siege to a city for a long time, fighting against it to capture it, do not destroy its trees by putting an axe to them, because you can eat their fruit. Do not cut them down. Are the trees of the field people that you should besiege them? However, you may cut down trees that you know are not fruit trees and use them to build siege works until the city at war with you falls.
Thank you, Christine. first thing to say is that there are many texts in the Old Testament that describe terrible actions during war, but that does not necessarily mean that they are sanctioned by God. The Old Testament is a description of human life, warts and all. Doesn't mean to say necessarily they're sanctioned by God. Nevertheless, there are some places where God directly commands the Israelites to destroy the nations who are in the promised land. So in verses 1 to 9, we're given some instructions really. When you face a more powerful army, verse 1, when you see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours. Well, you might think that this would result in conscription, the enlisting of all able-bodied men. It's fascinating though, isn't it, that what actually happens is quite the reverse. New homeowners, vineyard planters, those engaged to be married, and the fearful are all released to go home. I never had an experience of being preparing with a regiment to go to war, but I had plenty of experiences with the battalions of going abroad on exercises. And you could guarantee that for the 2 or 3 weeks before those exercises, people would be meeting a path to my door with a whole load of reasons why they couldn't go, because they didn't want to be away from home for 6 or 8 weeks. And I had to listen to those reasons as the chaplain and try and sift out what was genuine and what was not. The army takes seriously the needs of soldiers' families, but it says in its ethos, really, that the needs of the service must come first. So I can't imagine the British Army working on this sort of principle if we were at existential threat from wherever that might come. But this is what seems to happen here. People are released to go home. What's that saying? Perhaps this, that family and community are more important than war. That trust is to be placed in God who will fight for them. In verses 10 to 15, the instructions are around what happens when you attack a city outside the land of Israel. Option 1, seek peace through surrender and then forced labour. Slavery? Yes, but it's a fairly mild form of takeover, believe me, by ancient world standards. On one occasion, the servants of a defeated king, defeated by the Israelites, servants went to King Aram and said to him, "Look, we've heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful. Let us go to the king of Israel with sackcloth around our waists and ropes around our heads. Perhaps he will spare your life." Option 2, if the city resists, men are to be killed and the rest to be taken as booty. Unacceptable? Well, you need to read it in its own context, because sometimes in war, what seems like harsh actions are required in order to prevent further battles. So to take all of the menfolk who are of fighting age out of the equation means there will be no further battle. And symbolic examples need to be made so that those nations who are looking on are deterred from attacking again. Elsewhere in Deuteronomy chapter 21, there are suggestions that the intentions are to integrate women and children into the nation. That's in verses 10 to 14 of chapter 21. Verses 19 to 20 tell us about what should happen when Israel besiege a town. Now here we see rules that even in that besieging, attempt to limit the destructive power of war, demonstrating an awareness of the ecological needs of the land. Do not cut all the trees down. War is not such an overwhelming priority that it permits the use of any means to achieve an end. There is a bigger picture. Lastly, when Israel attacks cities within the land of Israel, we come to the hardest of all the instructions. There are acute moral problems here for us. It says annihilate everything, verses 16 to 17. Why? Verse 18 says, otherwise they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshipping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. Now this is a very serious instruction, so serious because it flows straight from the first of the Ten Commandments, which says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an idol in the form of anything in the heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the father to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments." So this seems to contradict the character of God revealed in the rest of the Bible as loving, just, and merciful to all. Indeed, Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 18, just 10 chapters early, says this: "God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing." The key question is whether this extreme measure is the only realistic possibility of creating and preserving a culture that is to hold fast to the true God. But you might ask, why is the preservation of Israel among the nations any more important than those nations themselves? Why does Israel have precedence? To understand that, you've got to go back to God's covenant with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, where God promises Abraham that he will make him into a great nation, bless him, he will make his name great, and he will be a blessing. God will bless Abraham, bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. You see, God's purpose in having a people is that he wants that people to be his feet, his arms, his legs, his person in the land for the salvation of the whole world. And if that people gets wiped out, that purpose and plan of God is removed, ends. Now we, and I believe God, would prefer a gentler and less extreme policy. But it doesn't seem to be an option in our fallen world. Now, some have taken this to talk about the concept of a holy war, but you never find that being described in the Bible. God is a Lord of war, but he is also the living God, and there is a distance between God and death in any form. For example, David, who had been a warrior and had committed murder and adultery, was not permitted to build the temple. Instead, his son Solomon, whose name means peace, was to do it. God distances himself, in a sense, symbolically from the soldier and the warmonger in that way. War may be unavoidable, but was never intended by God from the beginning. Now, you could say a lot more, and I haven't got time, but you could look at Jeremiah chapter 21, where Jeremiah announces to the Babylonian superpower that they're going to be defeated. And there's a fascinating conversation there. There's a fuller article that actually many of these thoughts I've drawn from here, which I'm very happy to lend, or you can get yourself. It's quite a helpful little Grove booklet on this problem. But in summary, what I'm trying to say here is that war in the Old Testament is complex and contradictory. It's complex because God takes a range of stances in relation to Israel's wars. He sometimes fights for them, and all they need to do is to trust. Sometimes he guarantees their success. Sometimes success is tied to the godliness of the king. Sometimes God uses other nations to wage war against Israel as a discipline. It's also in some ways ambivalent and contradictory. Some wars appear to be by the command of God, but there are contradictions and paradoxes that undermine any view of war as the primary will of God. So, for example, fighting is necessary, but the fighting King David is not to build the temple. Because I believe that God is, first of all, a God of mercy, justice and compassion, who desires life and peace. But then, war is also conditional and incomplete. Success in war in the Old Testament seems to depend on just leadership and good society. And if those things are absent, then Israel is not successful. And lastly, war is incomplete. The whole idea of war and warfare to bring about God's ends is incomplete. You see, when Jesus comes in the New Testament, he comes as the Prince of Peace. But he comes to a world that is still fallen. And we live in a world that is still fallen. And I think it's right to say that his example has helped to guide many people, not all, but many people involved in war, in the right conduct of war. So how do we interpret these two testaments? Well, there are three possible approaches. First of all, you could completely emphasize the continuity and say that it's the same God, the same message, and we should give no credence to anybody who suggests that the God of the Old or the New Testament is different. Now, the only problem with that approach, that I would suggest unthinking approach, is that actually the Old Testament describes what we know as a theocracy, which is where the king and God, the power, the secular power, so to speak, and God are inextricably linked together. The king is to do the will of God. Now, today, that is not the case. Yes, there are still prayers in Parliament. We still have bishops in Parliament. I think those are good things. But Christendom, the way that actually it was the case in the Old Testament, or at least theocracy, and times at the beginning of Constantine, when he came to faith in the 3rd century, where the state and the church were inextricably linked, is no longer. Decision-making is done from a different perspective. So I don't think we can necessarily emphasise too much continuity. The other option, though, is to emphasise the discontinuity. And we look at the Old Testament and we say, well, it's antiquated, it's primitive, it's perhaps even irrelevant. I think you need a bit of both, actually. You need a bit of continuity and a bit of discontinuity. You see, the New Testament does bring something new. Jesus came to transform, but there was a continuity as well about that transformation. The new order by Jesus is inaugurated. Yes, he is the Prince of Peace. But much of that old order still abides until Jesus comes again. And so just as in the Old Testament times, we have at times had to go to war. And when people ask me, how can you be employed, involved in that? My answer to them is that war is always the last resort. And so I feel comfortable being involved. Comfortable is not perhaps the right word. But I feel it's the right thing to be involved in the last resort. And perhaps just as we conclude, it's important to say that out of a Christian understanding of war has flowed some of the most important philosophical groundings for how war should be conducted. So you take two Christian theologians like Thomas Aquinas and Augustine of Hippo. They help to develop what we understand to be just war theory. Just war theory has two sets of criteria to it. It describes the actions that should be taken when we decide whether or not we should go to war, the right to go to war. And the second part of it is how we should conduct ourselves within war. So within that discussion about whether or not we should go to war, just war theory suggests we should ask these questions. Is there a just cause? It's not just about recapturing stuff that we lost or punishing people who've done wrong. Innocent life must be in imminent danger. It should be comparative and comparable. If the injustice is suffered by one party, then the justice should be brought in an equal way. So, you know, the worst examples of people dropping bombs on villages where there's a sniper in the village, it is not a comparative way of doing justice. Just war theory says that there should be a competent authority. It's only a duly constituted public authority that may wage war. In other words, in our country, it's Parliament. Parliament has to make a decision whether or not to go to war. There must be a good probability of success. You may not use your army in a futile cause. And it must always be as a last resort. And then within war, the right conduct within war is similar sorts of ideas, but there should be the principle of distinction. War should always be directed towards enemy combatants and not towards non-combatants. And having been through plenty of military training on this, there are very, very specific rules of engagement that soldiers are given in the British Army for engagement in war. Should again be proportional, and it should be governed by the principle of minimum force. So there's just a little hint as to how I think the Christian tradition continues today to influence, and hopefully influence for the better, our conduct of war in this fallen world. But it is without doubt a very complicated and at times confusing situation. I'll just remind you at those points. War in the Old Testament is complex, contradictory, conditional, and incomplete.